It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at student financial aid. Our guest journalist says a surprising amount of aid goes to wealthier college students. Low-income students who need help are being left behind.
First, this year marks the 35th anniversary of the Trapper Keeper binders, bringing lots of memories from people who grew up with them.
Yeah, I did. I think I've blocked out a lot of junior high, but I kind of remember I transitioned from pictures, and I can't remember of what, to like solid colors, to those psychedelic ones that came along later.
The question is, did you actually use your Trapper Keeper?
I did, yeah.
No, I didn't. I bought them and they just gathered dust.
Too organized for you.
Exactly. Well, joining us now to talk about this piece of American culture is Erin McCarthy. She's joining us to talk about the history and popularity of the Trapper Keeper. She's deputy editor at Mental Floss. Erin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, just in case someone just can't quite remember what those Trapper Keepers are, what are they?
They were these, or they are, they're still around. They're three-ring binders, basically, that close with a flap, and they have folders inside, portfolios that have vertical pockets. And they came in all kinds of different colors, kinds of fun, cool designs, and they had like puppies and kittens and horses and stuff on them.
And this is a big innovation for school kids, right? This caught on in part because there was nothing like it at the time.
Yes, that's true. And they really, really researched. You know, this was no accident. They spent a lot of time figuring out, you know, exactly what kids needed and going to focus groups and saying, you know, teachers, is this something that you would recommend? And asking kids how they would improve it. And yeah, that's why it became popular.
So how did this get designed since it had never existed before?
Well, E. Bryant Crutchfield worked at Mead, and he, you know, part of his job was going and figuring out what the new trends were going to be in the school supply market. And he hired someone to do some analysis, and they figured out that classes were going to be longer, people were going to be taking more classes, they're going to be needing to leave things in their lockers. And he just took that and rolled with it. He said, you know, you can't take 650-page notebooks to a class with you, but you can take portfolios in a notebook with you. And he just sort of went from there.
How quickly did these turn into a must-have for kids? Because I remember the highlight, man, of school shopping season was picking out the Trapper Keeper for the year.
I mean, I think almost immediately. They did some testing in a test market in Kansas, and what they did was very unusual. They actually ran commercials, which I don't think anyone had ever done for a school supply before, leading up to the school year in 1978. And kids saw that, and they went and bought them, and they just completely sold out, which obviously no one had been expecting. They, you know, Bryant knew that there was a market for this thing, but they just didn't expect for it to go off like a rocket, as it did. And then when it rolled out nationally, they did the same thing. They created a commercial campaign. They ran it during primetime, and kids saw it and they wanted it.
You know, one of our producers, Galen, said that he remembered there being sort of a spike in Trapper Keeper popularity after the political reference binders full of women. I can't remember who said it now. Do you remember?
Mitt Romney. Yeah,
Mitt Romney
mentioned campaign. Yeah.
Binders full of women, and Galen thought he remembered people dressing up as Trapper Keepers for Halloween. So does that mean they're a collector's item now?
They are a collector's item. If you actually go on eBay, they sell them. There are a ton of them. And actually, when I started working on this story, I had had my eye on one for about a year, and I finally bought it.
What was it? Which one?
It has zebra stripes. Cool. But, you know, I didn't want anybody else to buy it. And I thought, you know, if I publish the story and someone goes and buys that Trapper Keeper, I'm going to be really sad. So I bought it myself.
Well, and these things, did you write at the beginning of your piece, these things were kind of status symbols in school, and you have an anecdote from someone you talked to about that.
Yeah, actually, he's one of my friends, and I put up a call on Facebook and said, you know, do any of you remember your Trapper Keepers, any fond memories? And he came back with this very sort of sad anecdote about, you know, being a new kid in school, and everybody else had Trapper Keepers, and he didn't have one, and it was just, you know, horrifying for him.
I guess they were the must-have school accessory. And can you give us a sense about, are they still around today? If you have one, are you going to get sand kicked in your face, or are you going to be cool?
They are still around today, but they're a lot different than they were when we were kids. You know, back then they were sort of about showing off your personality. These days, they're kind of more in the vein of organization. So, you know, you'll have a lot of solid colors and a lot of corresponding folders in those colors for different subjects and things like that. So they're just slightly different. They're not, you know, as funky as they used to be, I guess.
Why did they dial back the funkiness? Because it seems like that was part of the appeal, was that you could have, you know, the whatever pop culture thing. You could go straight. You could have animals. You could have unicorns, whatever. Why wouldn't they keep doing that?
I mean, that's a really good question. I think part of it is because school trends are changing. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on organization in the classroom, and that might be part of the reason why. It also might have shifted to some of their other brands, you know, like Mead has Five Star and, you know, some other brands. And I think those tend to have a little bit more fun covers and things these days. I don't really know the answer, but I think it's probably because of changing school trends.
Now, you're right that at the time, some schools actually banned them. Why was that?
Well, there are a lot of different reasons. Thankfully, my school was not one that banned them. But, you know, for every reason from the Velcro making noise, which was really annoying to teachers, or, you know, there was a lot of times teachers would think that they were banning a Trapper Keeper. What they had in mind when they said Trapper Keeper was actually a really big three-ring zipper notebook. So completely different things. You know, it's sort of like a Kleenex or a Band-Aid thing, you know, not all Band-Aids are Band-Aids, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Not all tissues are Kleenexes. And, you know, so teachers were banning these big binders that they were calling Trapper Keepers, but weren't actually Trapper Keepers.
I keep having these mind explosions as we talk. The Velcro triggered it because I remember messing around with the Velcro. And it was, I remember, purple and then like these yellow and orange psychedelic things. Or I'm having some kind of weird flashback.
You are. You're having an out-of-body experience about Trapper Keepers.
It's all coming back. It's going to be like Proust, man. Remembrance of things past triggered by the Trapper Keeper
Velcro.
But you're
going to be remembering junior high. Do you really want that?
Yeah, no, good point. Yeah, I don't want to go there.
Come back to us, Rob. Well, tell us about, you know, where they might be. So they're redesigned. Are they still super hip, though, like they used to be? Have they reached that pinnacle of popularity?
I mean, I'm not sure. Probably not. I think they're, like I said, I think the focus is a little bit different for them these days. So maybe you carry them, but they're sort of like more like a regular school supply now. Whereas, you know, when I was growing up, it was really, you really wanted to have one. You were really cool if you had one. If you didn't have one, you were not so cool. So, you know, I think it's just a different focus.
Aaron, we're all grown-ups now, you know, more or less. Do you think, I mean, would Trapper Keepers be useful for an adult?
I think so. I mean, as someone who has one at her desk right now.
With the zebra stripes.
With zebra stripes on it. I mean, I do think so. I think the only thing that might make them not quite as effective maybe is the plastic binder clips that slide open instead of snapping open. You know, they're kind of unwieldy. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm using mine right now. It's got papers in it. It's great. You know, I can have a different Trapper folder for every, you know, meeting that I have. It's pretty awesome.
Now you have your zebra one. Do you have a cherished one of days of yore like Rob did?
I wish I did. I know that I had one, but I can't actually remember what was on it. My mother assures me that it was probably pink. But beyond that, I mean, I wish I had kept it. You know, I kept my American Girl dolls, but not my Trapper Keeper.
Yeah. All right. Well, Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
That was Aaron McCarthy. She's deputy editor of Mental Floss.
Coming up, is college financial aid going to the students who need it? Our guest says wealthy students are getting more, low-income students are getting less. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Public universities have often been seen as the most affordable option for students going for that four-year degree.
Recent trends in financial aid distribution, though, have made public schools less affordable for the neediest students. A new investigative report from ProPublica shows that public colleges have actually been shifting financial aid toward wealthier students. The goal, I guess, boosting numbers like average SAT scores and GPA.
Well, here with us to explain the trends is ProPublica reporter Marian Wang. She covers higher education. Marian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us, let's start with this. What is financial aid at universities designed to do?
Well, so from the federal level, the perspective on financial aid has always been to help the neediest students, students who are going to have a hard time financing a college education. And granted, the mix of that at the federal level has shifted from being, you know, grants to more and more loans. But it's always been about, you know, what does the student actually need? And, you know, one thing I'll point out is the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, I just looked this up, they say that the purpose of student financial aid is to ensure that everyone has equal access to post-secondary education. And it's and they stress that need-based aid should be primary in that.
And that seems to be changing then, in at least how colleges are choosing public colleges to distribute their aid. Tell us about this new trend that you're seeing.
Absolutely. That is increasingly not what we're seeing happen at institutions. So privates have long sort of taken this and run with it and taken financial aid and sort of started using it more strategically. What we're seeing now is that more and more public institutions are also adopting the same mentality when it comes to financial aid. And they're thinking about it much more as a recruitment tool to sort of incentivize certain students to get them to come. And whether it's out-of-state students or especially high-scoring students, it's looked at as sort of an inducement for particular students to come and often sort of labeled as merit aid. And that's increasingly that practice of what the industry calls financial aid leveraging, sort of a funny term. But it's that sort of mentality, using it less for looking at it, financial aid, less about with the approach of what does a student need in order to get to our institution and more in terms of how can the institution use its financial aid resources to get the students that it needs.
Now, how do the universities that are doing this, how do they justify it? I mean, is it just because the payoff of looking good on the books is more important so that they'll attract, you know, I guess, brighter students and be more prestigious on the national scene? Is that why it's justified?
Absolutely. That's one big argument that, you know, we help our states more and we help residents of the state when we become a more prominent university, when we are become national, we raise the profile of the institution, we bring, you know, economic development to the area. That sort of argument is definitely made. As well, there are definitely revenue pressures on these institutions. So some institutions are looking toward out-of-state students in particular to bring in more revenue because out-of-state students sometimes pay 2 to 3 times the, you know, in-state rate. And so even if you give a merit grant to a, you know, in an okay, you know, academically pretty good sort of out-of-state student, maybe not the best student that you enroll, but, you know, will bring in some money with very limited expenditures in terms of grant aid, you know, a $2,000, $3,000 scholarship, if that will get that student in the door, net revenue, they're bringing in a lot of net revenue.
So are public universities struggling with finances themselves? Is that part of this too, or is it more the prestige factor?
You know, it depends on the institution, but definitely across the board, you've seen publics in the last 5 years suffer pretty steep cuts in state support. And so that's definitely one component of this particular trend. And then prestige is always a factor. You know, actually, even Becky Blank, I think, chancellor of UW-Madison, recently said something at a Regents meeting, I believe, that essentially said she saw moving Madison up in the rankings as one of her primary responsibilities. So prestige is definitely a definite priority that a lot of these institutions have, and they're getting pressure from boards and from their leadership to sort of have that sort of concrete marker. Rankings are incredibly important to these institutions.
I want to see if we can put a face on this at all. You tell the story of a student who seems to have done all the right things, and yet she doesn't get the financial aid she needs. Tell us about some of the people who are being affected by this.
Yeah, so we profiled a student who lives in Pennsylvania. She's fairly low income, lives in subsidized housing, and it's exactly as you say. She went to a public school in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia's school district, if you know anything about it right now, is not doing well financially. Her school was actually closed after she left. And she did all the right things, worked really hard in high school, and applied to three state colleges, got accepted to three state colleges, and yet when she got her financial aid package, she didn't have anything there for her from the institution. She got federal need-based aid, state need-based aid, but as of a couple years ago, those things plus federal student loans, the most you can take out in federal student loans, in fact, those things stopped paying for even the most affordable colleges in affordable public colleges in Pennsylvania. And so you have this gap that's only growing as college costs rise. And when institutions aren't putting their financial aid resources to help bridge that gap for these students whose families actually have no ability to really borrow or comfortably borrow or pitch in, you know, you have the federal formula for financial aid saying that this family actually does not have the resources to contribute to, you know, it's called the EFC, expected family contribution, and her EFC was zero. And yet these schools are spending their financial aid dollars on different students.
Well, so what happens to someone like that? Does she end up at community college?
Well, increasingly, if you look at the numbers sort of systemically, you see low-income students with federal Pell Grants. That's sort of the common measure or proxy for low income. You see these students with Pell Grants, a smaller and smaller portion of them are going to four-year institutions in the private sector as well as the public sector. And you see a growing proportion of them being served by community colleges and by for-profit schools, frankly. And that was absolutely the case with her. She ended up looking at these financial aid packages, realizing she couldn't make it work, or it would be very risky for her to try to make it work in terms of taking on that amount of debt. And she ended up going to a community college. And that community college, you know, community colleges in our society are asked to do a lot, but they don't offer a ton of support for some of these students that are on the margins. And that community college, you know, first-year full-time students, only half of them return for the second year. So it's definitely when you go to a school that is less selective than the school that you could have gone to, the most selective option you had, you know, there's a overwhelming body of research that shows that these students are sort of lowering their chances of graduating.
So, Marian, if this continues and we see more of the financial aid going to wealthier students and lower income students, who I imagine are some students who come from more diverse backgrounds, what do you see as the long range picture here? And, you know, what it will reflect in society about earning potentials and who is in there contributing and, you know, living their lives to the fullest?
I think that's a really good question you raise and very troubling. Absolutely, you're right about the demographic shifts of this country changing. And, you know, even a couple weeks ago, or maybe even last week, it was the College Board put out a report showing that, you know, a large proportion of the students that take the SAT, they consider not to be college ready. And so that's definitely, and yet if schools, including public institutions, are going hard recruiting, spending money, trying to, you know, giving out merit scholarships to these students, this limited pool of students who they consider to be college ready and will lift their scores, who is going to be serving those students who are on the other end of the spectrum or who might have more difficulty paying? You know, family income is often extremely correlated with standardized test scores and that sort of metric. So when you have schools focusing on certain priorities over and not prioritizing or keeping on the table this question of access to higher education, I think it has some troubling implications. And definitely you see more students being funneled sort of toward these community colleges that are going to need more support.
Well, Marian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Marian Wang, reporter at ProPublica, covering higher education. And you can read more about that on the Central Time Facebook page. And by the way, stop by, tell us what you think. And are you concerned about the trend of financial aid going to wealthier students instead of traditionally it had gone to the students with the greatest need? What do you think about that trend? And are you concerned about it for your own family?
And while you're there, check out everything else, the other conversations going on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. So we do that Twitter thing. We are Central Time WPR. That's all one word. Coming up next, we're talking with a healthcare expert about how the Affordable Care Act that went into effect today, how that's going to change healthcare in Wisconsin. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Today's the big day for the Affordable Care Act. People can start signing up for healthcare exchanges. In a few minutes, we'll talk to the Deputy Commissioner of Insurance for the state of Wisconsin and find out how the transition is going here in the state.
First, Wisconsin's biggest cities and counties are trying to make sure eligible Wisconsinites sign up for health coverage. Veronica talked to WPR reporter Shemaine Mills earlier today.
Shemaine, what are city and county governments doing to try to get people signed up for the Affordable Care Act on this first day of the rollout?
Well, they've got what they describe as an all-hands-on-deck effort. It's a concerted push by counties around the state to use their existing social welfare agencies to reach out to these people who may be on Badger Care and aren't anymore, or those who may have never had insurance.
And are healthcare providers joining in the effort?
In some cases, like in Madison, the health department here is reaching out and helping people understand and, in some cases, point them in the direction of the coverage that may be suitable for their healthcare needs and what they can afford.
Now, when we say reaching out, what do we mean? How are people being approached?
For instance, in Dane County, the Job Center, where a lot of people go for food stamps or for writing resumes, a number of different things. They go there and there will be four certified application counselors, people licensed by the state, who can help people on this online marketplace called NXchange figure out if they can afford a privately subsidized plan or if they should be on Medicaid.
So people at that space, any other, you know, particular target audience that authorities are concerned about?
Well, mainly in Wisconsin, it's the Medicaid population that is no longer going to be eligible because of changes tightening up eligibility. We're talking tens of thousands of people, 92,000 people who are going to lose coverage. And this is the main concern of counties like Milwaukee and Dane County, where they're afraid these people won't have coverage and they'll go to the emergency room for care. So they want to get them hooked up to what may be their only option, the subsidized federal private plans. So,
Well, and over 90,000 people were notified recently that they no longer qualify for Badger Care coverage. What about these people in this effort of reaching out and getting people educated?
Well, it's going to be tough. All the advocacy groups say we already have contact with these people through the normal channels, say when they go get food stamps or they seek job assistance. But there still is an amazing lack of awareness. A Kaiser Family Foundation granted a national poll found 74% of those who could use the marketplace don't know when sign-up is or don't know much about the marketplace and what it may or may not be able to do for them. So it's going to be a big effort. And the state has decided not to put money into advertising. They thought it would be better to go through the normal channels, the local agencies that provide social services, rather than have TV or radio commercials. So they're definitely trying to get to people. Whether this will be the most effective way, we don't know yet.
So now, given that, is there a sense of anxiety out there that a lot of people could fall through the cracks, certainly at least maybe in the beginning of this.
There is, and officials say they're not worried about getting people signed up right away. The big day they're concerned about is December 15th, because if you don't have a plan by then, you won't have insurance for January 1st. Now, the enrollment period is 6 months long. It goes through March 31st. But the advocates are concerned that those, especially on BadgerCare, who are no longer going to have that assistance, if they don't get something by December 15th, they could have a gap where they won't have any insurance.
So if someone's got questions, they're listening right now, where should they go?
Our state health department, DHS, has a website where you can go find out more information. The Office of the Insurance Commissioner has information. There's an 800 number. And there's also the federal healthcare government website. That's called www.healthcare.gov.
Excellent. All right. Well, Chimaine, thank you so much for coming by and talking with us.
Thank you.
That was WPR reporter Chimaine Mills.
Now we'll find out how open enrollment will work in Wisconsin and answer your questions about the new healthcare law.
Do you have questions about what this means, how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Dan Schwartzer has been listening along. He's Deputy Insurance Commissioner for Wisconsin. Dan, thanks so much for joining us on this busy day, I imagine.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, now the Affordable Care Act marketplace sign-up is in effect. What changed to today?
So the big change, obviously, is that the exchanges, which are a federal website, were to go live today for the beginning of the time period in which people could look at insurers that operate in our state that have decided to display their rates on the federal exchange. And we have roughly about half of our market that thought that they wanted to display those rates on the exchange. The other half decided not to. And so consumers who are looking at getting individual coverage, which is a small part of our market. Roughly 200,000 people or less are in the individual market. Everyone else is in the group market or in Medicaid or Medicare. That they, if they want to start looking at January 1 effective dates, they can go on the exchange and look at those rates that are displayed on the exchange, or they can call their agent and broker and other means that they use to shop plans for the plans that aren't going to display their rates on the exchange.
So there are insurance companies that would meet all the criteria that people could go to. They just haven't, for whatever reason, decided to join in on the exchange website.
Exactly. There's a whole process that went into for an insurer to decide whether it made sense for them to display their rates on the exchange or not. And it all had to do with, you know, from a financial perspective, where they thought they would be, where they, you know, would they get more risk if they came into the exchange or not. We know the HRSA population is going into the exchange. There's just a lot of factors, and they're all based off of the carrier's specific circumstance and no other circumstance that they make a decision to be on the exchange or not be on the exchange.
Now, we heard Chimaine talking about the deadlines. Even if people aren't all flooding to sign up today, they have a little while left. Are you concerned, as people in Dane and Milwaukee counties are, that people don't know what's out there?
I heard her talk a little bit about the, you know, how is Wisconsin going to get the word out. And we did a lot of editorial visits, the OCI and DHS and the Secretary Rhodes talked about, you know, when Medicare Part D was rolled out, and she reminded us, and it's true that, you know, the federal government spent a boatload of money on advertising for Medicare Part D, but it really was when the consumer went to their pharmacist and they said, what does all this mean? Help me out here. So the you can spend all the money you want on advertising, and, you know, we're from the government. We're here to help you and sign up. But where most people go is where they trust, and it's people that they, you know, whether it's their doctor, their hospital, particularly the Medicaid population she was referring to, most of those folks really consistently on a day-in, day-out basis deal with the income maintenance workers that they're familiar with. And the income maintenance workers have been prepped and trained to understand what they need to do to help that population enroll. There's a lot of effort that's been made from an outreach perspective by both, particularly the Department of Health Services as well as OCI, and for that population by the Department of Health Services on this is what's happening, this is where you need to go, and we're going to help you get enrolled into one of the exchanges.
Let's strip it down to a pretty basic level. If you're an individual, you're uninsured, you want to get in on this exchange, get that individual coverage, what do you do?
Well, we recommend you do two things. The first thing you should do is go to healthcare.gov, see what the rates are that are displayed on the exchange, see if you qualify for one of the subsidies. And then even if you qualify for the subsidy, we then recommend you pick up the phone, contact one of your, a local agent or broker, have them shop the other carriers that aren't displayed on the exchange, and then find out what the best plan is for you. It is possible, because even though half of our market displayed rates on the exchange, they didn't display all of their products, all of the plans that they offer. Some did, but many did not. And so you may end up finding a carrier that's displaying even more plans in the outside market that may be less expensive based on deductibles and coinsurances that aren't on the federal exchange website. And you may, even with a subsidy, find a better plan in the outside market. It is quite possible. So we just recommend you do both. Find out the best quote. We continue to recommend you talk to an agent and broker, because they can help you not only on the outside market, but they can help you on the exchange as well. And so, if you're uninsured, you don't have coverage today, certainly look at the exchange, pick up the phone, call an agent and broker, have them get your proposals in the outside market, and kind of listen to their advice and see what's your best option.
We're talking to Dan Schwartzer. He's Deputy Insurance Commissioner for Wisconsin.
And what about you? Do you have questions about the Affordable Care Act and how it works, how to get yourself or your family covered? Call in and you can ask our expert. You're listening to Central Time, and our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. We continue our conversation now with Dan Schwartzer, Deputy Insurance Commissioner for Wisconsin, talking about the opening of the healthcare insurance exchanges starting today.
And we want to know what questions you have about how to get insured under the new act. We've got an expert in-house. You can call up now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
If he doesn't know the answer, he might know where to point you to find it. Dan, before we get to the phones, is there help out there? There might be people in this situation. They don't have a relationship with, say, an insurance broker. They don't know what the heck to do. Is there help out there for them? Is it just the federal call center, or is there something else?
Well, certainly there's the federal call center, the number that you just read through, and then there's also online chat help with healthcare.gov. But there are resources that both the Department of Health Services on their website, as well as our Office of Commissioner of Insurance and the website that we have, that we try to provide guidance, some help, where to go, some resources that are available. There is now navigators and certified application counselors. I think I heard you talking about that earlier. And they're also there to attempt to help. We did create a navigator and certified application counselor law, so that we could license and regulate them to make sure that we had some strong consumer protections. And we certainly recommend that if you run into a navigator in CAC, because they are out there now, to go ahead and talk to them. We certainly recommend that you check our website first, that they're licensed and regulated, because we are concerned about potential identity theft and fraud. So just make sure, go on our website, make sure that they're licensed. And if they are, then that's another resource, an additional resource that wasn't there before.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Holly with us in Eau Claire. Holly, you're on the air.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, okay, if you're on Badger Care and you have children, so you're on the Badger Care Plus, which is probably, the best one. Is this going to affect anyone on that?
Well, first of all, the changes on the Medicaid by moving folks from Medicaid above 100% of the federal poverty level to the exchanges is really only for adults, childless adults. You still have the option of keeping your kids on Badger Care if you desire. That's more of a Medicaid question, so I'm walking a little bit out on a limb on answering that question. That's a question for either Brett Davis or Kevin Moore, but over at DHS.
But the I've heard their
presentation
long
enough.
Off of that?
I'm sorry?
The parents, though, that are on that same plan with them kids are going to have to do this other Obamacare thing?
They would then go to the exchange and look for coverage on the exchange, and then likely if you're, you know, if you're in the those that are being moved from Medicaid to the exchange are between 100 and 200% of the federal poverty level, and that's really where the bulk of the subsidies are, not just the premium tax credit subsidies, but those cost-sharing subsidies that also help you pay for part of your deductibles and co-insurances, your out-of-pocket costs.
Holly, thanks a lot for the call, and good luck getting that sorted. We've got Steve with us now in Algonquin, Illinois. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I like your new format, by the way. My situation, I'm 64, not eligible for Medicare, but I will be in April. I've lived in Illinois. We're moving to Wisconsin.
Yay.
I'm on a program in Illinois because I had a heart attack in 2006. Lost my group health insurance at the end of 2009. That program lapses at the end of this year because of the implementation of the ACA. It doesn't look like the individual mandate will be delayed, so I need to find out if I can get on to Wisconsin's program through the ACA prior to moving to Wisconsin. That's going to take place sometime in November, so that as of the beginning of the year, I've got health insurance until I get eligible for Medicare in April.
Gotcha. Thanks, Steve, and I'll be the first to welcome you to Wisconsin. Any guidance for him, Dan?
Sure. The insurers, whether you're on the exchange or whether you're off the exchange, at this starting January 1st, are not allowed to ask health questions anymore, so it becomes a guaranteed issue. Before, Wisconsin had a guaranteed access program, so anyone that was sick could get coverage. But it was through a pool where the insurers all contributed directly to the pool called HRSP, Health Insurance Risk Sharing Plan. In Wisconsin, that too goes away on December 31st because the new law requires the insurers to no longer pool their money to cover high-risk individuals but to take them on individually. So whether you go into the exchange, whether you go in the outside market, all insurers have to take you regardless of health conditions and without any pre-existing conditions limitations. So effective, you know, January 1st, that goes into effect. The key would be for you to shop the market, again, both off the exchange and on the exchange, and make your decision before December 15th and make sure you sign up by December 15th so that you can get coverage for January 1st.
All right, Steve, good luck with your health. Good luck with the move north of the border. We'll go now to Susan in Janesville. Susan, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is I'm on disability and Medicare, and I'm low income, so I am also getting Medicaid. I don't understand all this that's going on. Will this affect me?
So what I would do in this circumstance is I'm gonna partially answer the question, but I would certainly recommend you get a hold of Department of Health Services. They can tell you specifically what your options are, but the Medicaid changes don't take place for those that are disabled, those that are children, or women that are pregnant. They are strictly for the childless adults and caretakers and adults of children that fit within that income level, that federal poverty level. So, you know, depending on your disability, if you are disabled and you're on Medicaid, this change shouldn't affect you. But I would highly recommend you get a hold of the Department of Health Services, and they can tell you specifically, because that is a Medicaid question, they can tell you specifically, you know, whether or not you're affected by the federal changes.
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. That reminds me, Dan, of another question I was going to ask about people who aren't affected. People who are currently get their health insurance through an employer, today means nothing to them as of right now. Is that right?
I think for the most part that's right. When we talk about the federal law and who's affected, certainly if you're Medicare, if you're above 65 and you're on Medicare, you really don't have any changes at all from the federal law. for everyone under 65 but not on Medicaid. In the individual market, today's a big day. You're starting to look at the exchanges. And then if you're in the group market, you really don't see, if you get your coverage through your employer, you're not going to really see many changes this year. I think where you'll see changes is in next year's renewal, starting around September, October of next year. If there's an effect on the rates because of the law and you're currently covered by a group, a lot of employers are going to these early renewals, which allow them to not have to feel the effects of the law until they renew next year. And so you're probably not going to see much changes in the way of your premium till next year if you take one of these early renewals. You'll also then, at that point, see changes in your plan. Many of the plans have to change to some extent because of the limitations on the out-of-pocket costs. Many plans have higher out-of-pocket costs than are required by the federal law. And a lot of insurers, quite frankly, are shrinking their networks because of the federal changes. So they're beginning to narrow their networks. So you may see provider changes as well. You may not be able to see the same provider that you've been seeing in network. They may become an out-of-network provider. So just pay attention, you know, constantly talk with your employer, find out what he or she's looking at in terms of whether they did the early renewal or not. But for today, October 1st, no, you're not going to see any changes today.
Time for one more call. Thanks for that call, by the way. We've got Bill in Milwaukee on the line. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a lot of questions, but I know you don't have a lot of time, so I'll just ask the big one.
All right.
I was diagnosed with a chronic disease a couple of years back. I've been out of work for a number of years. I do no tax reports, file income taxes. I don't make enough. I'm working hand to mouth and living off my savings and selling off the things I own to stay alive. Now, where am I going to fit into this? I have nothing that I can afford, you know. There's nothing, you know, if they said it's $50 a month, I don't have that kind of money right now.
Gotcha.
What do I do?
If it sounds like you would be, and I'm just guessing, so, you know, if I'm wrong, please forgive me, but it sounds like you'd be under 100% of the federal poverty level, in which case you qualify for Medicaid. And the governor's decision on Medicaid was not only to move those above 100% into the exchange, but for everyone under 100%, even childless adults, to take on and make sure that we as a state cover everyone under 100% of the federal poverty level, even if we're paying for it on our own dime. He felt that that was the safety net that we needed to provide. So it sounds like you're under 100% of the federal poverty level, in which case you would now qualify for Medicaid.
Dan, thanks a lot for coming on today and answering people's questions. I appreciate it.
You bet.
That was Dan Schwartzer, Deputy Insurance Commissioner for Wisconsin. Well, there are going to be a lot of questions, I think, in the days and weeks to come, and you can get some answers tomorrow morning at 6. Joy Cardine will be talking about healthcare exchanges in Wisconsin, what's new, more of what we've been talking about now, and maybe how the first day has gone. That's tomorrow morning after 6 on The Joy Cardine Show.
Coming up next, we're talking to the author of a memoir about raising a child with Down syndrome. The author has some changes that she'd like to see, given how society relates to people with disabilities. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.